I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the transformation of an elevated train line into a public space about a mile and a half long on the west side of New York City. Robert co-founded Friends of the High Line with Joshua Davin, whom he met at a community board meeting to protest the High Line's demolition in 1999. The park opened to the public in 2009. Robert and Josh are the authors of the book The High Line, the inside story of New York City's Park in the Sky. Welcome.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
What does the High Line look like?
Well, I mean, it was originally an old elevated rail line. So, you know, when I first saw it, it was sort of this resting structure. But now we've cleaned it up a little bit, and there's a park on top. So you're about three stories in the air walking through the city, you know, sometimes through buildings, and it gives you just all these different perspectives on the city.
Now, the High Line was first created in the 1930s as a safety mechanism because you had trains at street level who were killing people, basically running them over, and then they were abandoned by the 1980s. Why were they abandoned?
Because with the rise of interstate trucking, the line was used less and less, and, you know, its heyday was really, you know, right after it was built, 30s, 40s. But by the 60s, it was used less and less. And the last train was a trainload of frozen turkeys that ran at Thanksgiving around right before Thanksgiving in 1980. So it wasn't that long ago that it was still, you know, an active train line. But, you know, and the trains ran, what you know, you're saying people were killed. 10th Avenue was nicknamed Death Avenue because so many people were run over by the trains. And the railroad hired a guy on horseback to run in front of the trains, and he became nicknamed the West Side Cowboy.
What other deliveries were made, aside from frozen turkeys, to these buildings along the High Line?
I mean, it was actually a lot of food. The nickname for the High Line was the Lifeline of New York because it brought in a lot of food to Manhattan. And a lot of the buildings that are still next to the High Line used to be windowless refrigerated warehouses. And now they're offices and residences, and they punched windows through. Also, the Nabisco factory, which is now Chelsea Market at 15th Street, you know, they were baking cookies. You know, the train would actually bring in the eggs and the flours, and then the trains would take out the Oreos that would go all over the U.S.
So in 1999, the city and developers and residents were planning to demolish the High Line, and you attended a community board meeting to help protest this demolition. What were you doing at that moment in your life?
I was working for a watch retailer and helping them launch an internet division, sort of right during the internet boom. So my background was in, you know, for-profit startups, a lot of internet companies. And I read an article in the Times that the High Line was going to be demolished and had a little map, and it showed that it was a mile and a half long. And I'd seen parts of it, but I just thought it was all chopped up. And so that's when I thought, wow, this is, you know, a mile and a half of Manhattan. You know, that doesn't come around very often.
You mentioned this was in the 1990s, mm-hmm. and this was the heyday of internet startups, which helped 20-somethings like yourself, you know, think that they could run these multi-million-dollar companies. How much was that in your psychology of wanting to think big for yourself?
Oh, I think it was a huge part. Early 20-year-olds were taking companies public for hundreds of millions of dollars. So, you know, it didn't bother me that I didn't have any experience necessarily. But, you know, when we were starting it, I thought my role and Josh's role would just be to get it started, and then someone else would do it. But pretty quickly we found out some people might have been excited, but they didn't want to take it on.
You take a year off every 10 years. It just so happened that when you were thinking about starting this project for the High Line, it coincided with one of your years off. Can you describe how you decided ultimately to take that year to
Yeah, I mean, it's not a scientific process. It's just when I was in college, I met my boyfriend, or my first boyfriend, or the first guy I ever kissed, and we were not out of the closet. We didn't know what to do, so we dropped out of college told our parents we were taking a year off. And we ended up moving to Hong Kong and doing construction work and traveling to Southeast Asia, worked on the stock exchange here, and just it was a great year. I mean, it was an amazing year. It was so helpful. And that's when I made the promise to myself that I would try every 10 years or so, you know, to take some time off for myself. And then, you know, so it was really sort of a coincidence there. When I started, I was 29, and that watch retailer later in the year got bought out by Sunglass Hut. So I made a little bit of money and had enough money to take a year off. And I thought I would travel and figure out what I wanted to do next. But ended up staying in New York and focusing mostly on the High Line. And was really enjoying it. But I still thought, oh, this is just something I'll do, you know, just during this year off.
And to what extent was your opposition to wanting to take this on initially the fact that you'd be running a nonprofit or, you know, socially minded organization versus a for-profit organization?
I mean, I definitely had never had any desire to run a nonprofit. You know, I'd never had any desire to go to a community board meeting before I went to that one. So, you know, that was part of it. I just didn't also think running a nonprofit could be that interesting. And that was a huge mistake.
Right.
And it's actually very similar to startups. Because, you know, when you're in a startup, more than half of your time is consumed by raising money. And that's the same thing in nonprofit. The problem is, you know, in a for-profit, either you stop making money and you go under. Nonprofit, the more successful you are, the more money you have to raise.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, the co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the creation of the High Line, an elevated public park in New York City. You went to Princeton, and you weren't openly gay until mid-college. What was that like for you growing up in Texas, knowing that you were gay? Or did you not know at the time?
I don't know. I mean, I definitely knew, but I didn't really think about it that much. Mm-hmm. You know, and I was really fortunate to come out at a time when I did, because it was a very much easier, you know, in the early 90s to come out than mm-hmm. I think even, you know, 5 years before. My parents were very supportive. My family was really supportive, and my friends were really supportive. So it really wasn't. And then I moved to New York, where it's pretty easy.
Your parents were involved in civic-minded projects when you were growing up in San Antonio. For instance, your father helped to found Friends of the Parks in San Antonio. Is it accidental that you came to this place, or how did that inform what you're doing now?
Yeah, I mean, for a long time, I always thought the High Line reminded me of my mother, because my mother was always interested in odd projects and sort of taught me from a young age to see, sort of find beauty in odd places. And then it was, I don't know, maybe like 3 or 4, it might have been 5 years after I'd been working on the High Line that I realized that the things that my dad, when I was growing up, the things my dad did outside of work were he was involved in preservation, parks, and architecture. And, you know, here I was working on a project that combined all three of those things. You know, so I think I was sort of slow to see, and he was kind enough not to point it out.
Which implies a healthy relationship with your parents.
Yeah, no, I'm pretty lucky. I think I have had an atypical Texan childhood. I became obsessed with Russia when I was in middle school after reading Nicholas and Alexandra. And my parents let me go to Russia when I was in middle school by myself. And then they let me live over there for 3 years in high school in 87, which, you know, wasn't what most Texan parents, you know, wanted their kid to go live in the Soviet Union at the time.
What do your siblings do? You have a brother and a sister.
Yeah, my brother is an Episcopal priest in Fredericksburg, and he lives there with his wife and two kids.
In Texas,
yeah. And my sister lives in Dallas, and she has 4 kids.
You mentioned that when you were doing the project, it seemed obvious to you that you were paralleling your mom's eccentric life to some degree. Your mom, for instance, kept bees in your living room in Texas, and she was also a kite maker and collector. Talk to me about that.
Yeah. The year I was born, she heard about the National Kite Flying Championship that happens on the Mall. The Smithsonian hosts it every year. She'd never really done anything before, but the rule was you had to make your own kite and fly it yourself. So she made a kite and went to Washington, and she won the National Kite Flying Championship. And then went on to collect, I think one time she had the largest collection of kites in the United States. She had several shows, making her own kites. And then, you know, she would, every few years, she would get a new hobby, from collecting brooms to animal vertebras to, you know,
Whistles.
She doesn't whistle. I mean, you could probably name a top collection, the downstairs bathroom, the bathtub is filled with all different devices that make bubbles.
I read a quote. She said, "A kite and a person have many similarities. They both have skin and bones and rely on the same thing to get them going: air."
Yeah. When she said, when I was she loved the name Highline because high of kite flying. And she, there's, I don't know if it was her quote or someone else's, but she always used to say, it's hard to have bad thoughts when you're looking up. That, like, when you look down, one, you're usually not as happy, but it also makes you more unhappy. When you look up, you're just sort of already either happier or it makes you a little happier. And that's something, you know, that's connected to the Highline.
I want to go back to 1999 when you heard about this potential demolition of the Highline. You went to this community board meeting just as a concerned citizen in the West Village, and you happened to be sitting next to this guy, Joshua David, who became your partner. Did you both come up with the idea, you know, let's start this, or was it more of a eventual process?
It was more like, oh, you know, here's my business card. Oh, here's, you know, we exchanged business cards. And I said, well, I'm really busy. Why don't you do something? Mm-hmm. And I'll help. And he was like, well, I'm busier. You do it and I'll help, you know. Mm-hmm. So we were like, okay, well, let's talk.
David is a writer. And at the time, he was writing for magazines ranging from...
Yeah, Travel and Leisure, Gourmet, Wallpaper.
Were you at all in any way strange bedfellows?
Yeah, well, I think one of the reasons it worked is we are so different. His background was in writing and magazines. Mine was in startups. I think that's one of the things that has made it work is that we were precisely so different and that neither of us had any experience in planning, architecture. You know, that most people assume we were architects.
At what point did you say, you know what, we don't have a background in this. Let's come up with this competition.
From the beginning, we always said, he and I are not going to decide this. And that's why it was great that we weren't architects. I think if we had been architects, it would have been irresistible for us to want to design it.
Who were the architects for the project?
So it was led by James Corner Field Operations, who's a landscape architect. And he partnered with James Diller Scafidio and Renfro, architects, and also Pete Uldoff, who is the garden designer who picked a lot of the plants.
They became the designers of the project as a result of a competition that you held. And some other ideas in the competition ranged from a mile-long swimming pool to a roller coaster. What other ideas were there?
There was one idea where it was called a park prison. And the idea was sort of a political manifesto is that we should have to see the people that we imprison. So you'd have a park on the High Line, and in the I-beams in the middle, you would imprison people. So as you're having your leisure stroll, you'd also have to see people in prison. I mean, my favorite was the pool. This, because it was such a clean idea, this mile-long lap pool. And imagine, you know, swimming, you know, no lap turns. And then in the winter, it would become a, you know, a mile-and-a-half skating rink.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line. We'll hear more from Robert coming up. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the transformation of an elevated train line into a public space about a mile and a half long on Manhattan's West Side in New York City. Friends of the High Line relies on support from members to fund the ongoing maintenance of the park, as well as the expansion of its third section to be completed in 2014. The design for the High Line was determined through this competition that you held. In what way was opening this up to the public strategic?
There was one of our early supporters, a guy, Phil Ahrens, and he said, you know, don't show people designs. And it was one of the best pieces of advice. And I always, whenever I'm talking to people that are starting their own projects, everyone wants to rush to get into the design and show what it's going to look like. And, you know, I think there was a real advantage not to, because people could then imagine things that they want to see up there. And that's when we had this photographer, Joel Sternfeld, go up and shoot the High Line. And Josh and I think of him as almost sort of the third co-founder, because he took these photos that sold the project for us. You know, you could look at it and say, well, you know, it's just an abandoned railroad with weeds growing on it. But, you know, it's weeds growing on an abandoned rail track with the Empire State Building in the background. So this is Manhattan. And so, you know, people looked at that and saw all different things. Some people saw a chance to build something. Some people saw a chance for a garden. Some people saw perennials. Some people saw the wild grasses. Some people saw preservation. Some people thought train. You know, it enabled us to really create a broad group of support, not just sort of a narrow, you know, just architects or just preservationists.
So the lack of specificity really helped to facilitate this current of interest.
Yeah. But what the beauty of it is that it all came back, actually, ironically, to that very photo. When we asked people in the community, what did they want? They pointed to Joel's photo. And the beauty of what the design team did was they didn't just make it look exactly like that. They captured the spirit and the feeling of what was up there, but also added something new.
Ironically, the opposition to the project was almost helpful to you.
Yeah.
Can you describe that paradox?
Yeah. Well, at first, when we came on board, you know, we really didn't know who we were up against. But then it became pretty clear that the city, led by Mayor Giuliani, was against it. He signed a demolition order 3 days before he left office. The property owners in the neighborhood had been organizing to tear it down for years. And actually, a lot of people in the neighborhood, you know, just thought it was an eyesore. Even if they thought it would be nice if it was a park, they thought, these two guys are never going to make it happen, so you should just get it over with and tear it down. But, you know, my elevator pitch was, it's a mile and a half Manhattan. How often do you get a chance to think about that? I'd show them the Joel Sternfeld photo. If that didn't work, I could always say, and Giuliani hates it. And then people go, oh, really? Then it must be a great idea. I'd be happy to help.
When did you become more and more certain that actually, you know what, this is something that can happen despite the intransigence of this prior?
Yeah, I mean, I think I was one of the last people to believe that it would really happen. I mean, I'm a dreamer, but I'm also a realist and knew the chances from the beginning were very small. And then as we started making a lot of progress, we had just so many, it was so complex with so many legal, financial, regulatory, and political hurdles and just engineering problems that I was just convinced it wouldn't have taken a lot for it all to fall apart. I mean, Josh and I, part of the one thing that we're very much alike is we always sort of worrying and seeing the problems coming up. So we had a development director one time who said she was the only organization she'd ever been at. When you got a $1 million check, we just kept our heads down and kept typing on the computer and kept working. And it's still, it's now just still sinking in that this actually not only happened, but is actually working, you know, that people are liking it.
You obviously faced just an abundance of opposition. What were some of the darkest, like, personal moments for you? Like, did it ever get to a point where you just didn't like what you were doing?
Yeah. You know, I mean, for me, I like the process. The times I would get really upset and lose sleep, it was always interpersonal things.
Mm-hmm.
It was, you know, when Josh and I weren't getting along, you know, we've had our ups and downs. Most people, you know, assume that we're sort of best friends, and it's been really tough. And there's been several points in the project where we didn't think we could keep working together. And, you know, those were always in some ways the hardest time for me.
In the early days, you took the stance of you were neighborhood nobodies, you know, which...
Well, no, I didn't take... Someone called us neighborhood nobodies.
But you kind of ran with it. What's that quote? Don't be so humble. You're not that great yet.
No, we definitely play the humble game. We definitely play that game a little bit.
Yet, even though you played that game, you were quite professional and quite deliberate about certain things, one of which was hiring lawyers versus asking lawyers to work pro bono for you.
Well, I mean, one of the things I think most nonprofits or maybe anybody, you know, is loath to do is pay lawyers a lot of money. But at the time, we needed to sue the city on a very specific rail use and land use issue, and the lawyers that could do it pro bono weren't the best in that area. And the lawyers that were the best are usually hired by the city or the railroad, and they didn't want to do it pro bono. So that's when we realized, you know, that's how developers get things done. They hire the really smart lawyers. And so we wanted to take a page from that book. The High Line wouldn't be standing today if it wasn't for those lawyers. And we had to pay. We had to pay a lot of money. And that's in the early days. It wasn't that glamorous, but that's what we were raising money for, was to pay these lawyers to stop the demolition.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Robert Hammond, co-founder of Friends of the High Line, an organization that pioneered the transformation of an elevated train line in New York City into a public space. I want to talk a little bit more about the opposition. Why was opposition to keeping the High Line so fierce? And what was one impediment that disappeared that kind of helped to open the floodgates?
Well, the High Line was a railroad. CSX owned the High Line. But all they owned was the steel structure and a 30-foot easement above it. So there were 22 property owners that owned property underneath it and air rights above it. And they thought it would eventually come down, so they just wanted to tear it down. So that's why there was such opposition. And a lot of money involved because these developers, you know, had bought property hoping the High Line would come down so they could develop in that space. I mean, one of the developers said they spent over $3 million in legal fees fighting us. And then, you know, some people in the community, you know, to me, how romantic, a train running through your neighborhood. The reality was not romantic. It was dirty. It was loud. It smelled. You didn't live on the wrong side of the tracks. You lived under the tracks. And in some cases, their buildings had been demolished because they were worth more for parking than as buildings. So it had sort of put the neighborhood in a deep freeze, which for some people like me is interesting. But from an economic standpoint, you know, is not sustainable in a city like this. So a lot of people wanted to tear the High Line down and get on with it. And that's where Amanda Burden, who is the planning chair for the Bloomberg administration, came in and did a rezoning that allowed the property rights to be transferred within a district. It's what saved, you know, most people think it's Jackie O that saved Grand Central, which she did. But the legal mechanism was they allowed the railroad that owned Grand Central, ironically, to transfer their development rights anywhere in the neighborhood. Normally, you can only transfer it to your neighbor. It also saved the theaters in Times Square in the 90s. You know, it's used very infrequently. But Amanda passed this very complicated rezoning that allowed these developers to actually make money off owning property under the High Line. And then that's what got them on board.
Who were some of your unlikely supporters in the early days?
Well, we had Florent, but I mean, that didn't surprise. You know, Florent had this restaurant on Gansevoort Street that really was one of the early pioneers in the meat market. And he put us in touch with Diane von Furstenberg, who had a store in the neighborhood.
The designer married to Barry Diller, who runs Interactive Corporation.
Yeah, and her son and Barry, you know, really got behind the project and was one of our first really big, you know, financial supporters. Edward Norton was another one, the actor. He read an article that Adam Gopnik wrote about Joel's photos of the High Line that was in the New Yorker, and he read it and looked us up in information and called up Josh. And Josh was just sort of talking to him, and he said Edward Norton, and then halfway through he said, "Are you?" And he said, "Yes, I'm Edward Norton, the actor." And so he said, "Oh, I really want to help." He mailed us a check right away, would show up at meetings, go to community board meetings. I mean, he actually really dug in.
You also had a lot of support from the gay community in the West Village. Talk to me a little bit about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, Josh and I are both gay. And, you know, I think we thought traditionally, you know, nonprofits were run by people on the Upper East Side that you see in the style section of the New York Times or, you know, just famous rich people. And in the beginning, they weren't that interested in this project. So we tapped the people that we knew, which was our friends, which was a lot of gay people. I mean, one of my straight friends from college came to one of our first events, and he was like, "Wow, there are a lot of men here." You know, he didn't get it. It was all gay men except him. Herbert Muschamp, who was the old architecture critic for the Times, has this great quote about the story of preservation in New York is the alliance of gay men and rich women, straight women.
Speaking of straight women, there was a woman, Betsy Barlow Rogers, who founded the Central Park Conservancy. She was helpful to you.
Well, I mean, one, it's great. She's from San Antonio, my hometown. She went to high school with my dad. What she did is she created a private group that partnered with the Parks Department and the city to turn around Central Park and then help run it. And so, you know, without that precedent, the High Line was so unlikely, I don't think we could have ever pioneered yet a new model. And same with Dan Biederman at Bryant Park. And we were lucky to have a willing partner. You know, Bloomberg was willing, even though we had never done this before, was willing to see us as a credible partner.
In addition to help from Betsy, you also received help from a couple of classmates of yours from Princeton, one of whom was Gifford Miller.
Yeah, so Gifford was actually my boyfriend's roommate in college. When I first called up Gifford, he was a city council person, I think one of the youngest city council person ever elected at the time, and he said, "Well, that's a really stupid idea."
No, to you.
Yeah, and he said, "Why don't you call Christine Quinn? She's a local city council." You know, he was basically pawning me off, and Christine was actually much more supportive. But then we got Gifford to go up there, and Gifford really fell in love with it. And then another one of my best friends from college, Mario Palumbo, became our treasurer. He helped get his boss on board, a guy named Phil Ahrens. And he was a developer, and he helped give us a lot of credibility because all the developers in the neighborhood and the city thought it was a bad idea. So here was a really successful New York developer that was saying, this makes sense.
Robert Caro, or Bob Caro, who's the author of Power Broker, a book about Robert Moses, he came up with you one day to look at the High Line, and that was sort of one of your personal high points in all this. How come?
Well, I got a message on my machine, you know, from Bob Caro, and I was just over the moon, you know, and I took him and his wife up on a tour of, you know, when the High Line was still wild. And he was so excited about the project, and he was so complimentary to me. And that's when it really first started sinking in that, wow, I might be doing something really special. I read his book right when I moved to New York. It's such a great primer mm-hmm. on everything about New York. Mm-hmm. And there's a great section in The Power Broker where it talks about how Robert Moses builds the West Side Improvement Project, which was part of the High Line. And it cost $150 million in 1930, so equivalent to the Big Dig, you know, now. And he goes through several pages about how he got the money, piece by piece by piece. And I'm not a real Robert Moses fan, but it was also just sort of inspiring to see, you know, it doesn't come at once. You don't have to see how you're going to get the money. And so I always kept those pages, you know, by my, I'd Xeroxed them and they were, you know, by my desk.
In that way, you're similar to Robert Moses, but Robert Caro, who went up there, actually thought that your project was the inverse of something
yes.
Moses would do.
Yeah, I mean, he liked the irony that it was helped created by a Robert Moses project, but that Robert Moses would probably not have liked it.
Why?
You know, because it was a bottom-up project. You know, Robert Moses' project were the ultimate projects of top-down, you know, of government authority pushing it through, you know, against community support, where this project really started in the community and then sort of bubbled up.
You raised $150 million for phase one and two of the project. And this, by the way, the project was full steam ahead really during an economic crisis in 2008, 2009. Mm-hmm. What were your thoughts about that? Did you ever feel, you know, maybe this money could be used for schools? Or what was your psychology around that?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things we realized early on, and a guy who's also one of the people that's been really important to the project, a guy named John Alschuler, helped us do an economic feasibility study and to show how this would become an economic generator for the city. And, you know, that it wasn't, that it really made economic sense, that this was a good investment. And it's turned out to be, you know, true beyond our wildest dreams. You know, it's generated over $2 billion in development already. And we estimate it'll be about $900 million that'll be returned to the city in additional real estate taxes over 20 years.
People have said about you that you are a superior marketer. And that obviously, you know, that helped.
Yeah. You know, I think to me, one of the things that was important for me was the graphic identity and sort of graphics, which Paula Scher did our logo, you know, a few months after we started. And it's now the logo for the park. And so in a very early stage, we put a real emphasis on the graphics. And it was twofold. One, to make people think it was we had more going on than we did and that they'd want to get involved. But it was also that it was a commitment that we were going to follow through on good design.
And this is at a time when, you know, Steve Jobs and Apple are, you know, gaining acceleration. You have the iPod. How much of that was in your thoughts?
I remember that. I remember those iPod. We actually knocked off one of those early iPod mm-hmm. ads for one of our events. But it was a commitment that we weren't just going to put up a planter and put up a stair and call it a day.
You look a little bit, I think, like Jimmy Stewart, you know, and he was in this movie Rear Window by Alfred Hitchcock. And I actually think of Rear Window
yeah.
when I'm walking on the High Line because it's about just being up close with your neighbors. And you have people walking on the High Line and, you know, peeping in.
Yeah.
People are voyeurs like myself. And, you know, we like to see what's going on in the residences around you. Talk to me a little bit about, you know, that dynamic.
Yeah. I mean, one of the things we really we loved about when we first heard the design team is in their first interview. One, I loved because they were arguing amongst themselves in their interview, which I liked. But they also used the word, I think Liz Diller used it, was the word illicit. You felt like you were doing something, you know, not like hardcore illegal, but, you know, like riding your bike the wrong way on a street or something. And then, you know, right after we opened, the first big scandal was that the New York Post did a big story about you know, people standing on the High Line watching people have sex in the Standard Hotel, which is right above the High Line, which is a little bit, I mean, I look all the time and I never see it, but, you know, so it's become almost like an urban myth, and you'll see tourists just planted, staring up, you know, waiting for something, hoping something's going to happen in the hotel windows. But, you know, I also think, usually when you go up in buildings in New York, you go to the Empire State Building, you know, you're at this high vantage point and people look like ants. The High Line, you're just, you know, 30 feet above the street. So you can make eye contact with people on the street. It has this very different feeling and experiencing the city. It makes the city almost look quainter, not as majestic.
By the way, what do you do as a hobby?
I used to be more of a painter. I didn't study it, but I started sort of taking it up in the 90s. And right before I started the High Line, I'd had a few very, very small shows. And but lately, I haven't been painting that much.
You meditate daily. What kind of meditation do you do, and what does it do for you?
It's just a mantra-based meditation. It's so I learned to meditate, you know, several years ago, and it's just I do it 20 minutes in the morning and 20 minutes in the afternoon. And I always hit, I think like most people, this sort of a low or this wall, you know, I don't know, some glucose shortfall, you know, around 3 or 4. And so I originally would go back. We had an old storage closet, and I would go back there to meditate. And gradually, more and more people at the office have learned, and now there's almost 10 of us. And a lot of us, you know, every day at around 4, sometimes 6, we'll go back in the storage closet and meditate together.
Well, thank you very much for joining us. My guest has been Robert Hammond, co-founder of The High Line. Coming up, we'll meet Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris. This is From Scratch. My guest is Peter Manning, founder of Peter Manning, a clothing company focused on men 5'8 and under. Prior to launching the company in February 2012, Peter was a Tony Award-winning theater producer. Welcome.
Great to be here.
What percent of the population is under 5'8"?
25% of American men.
So why hasn't a company like this existed prior? You know, you see a bunch of fashion designers actually who are 5'8 or under, like Giorgio Armani, Mickey Drexler, J. Crew.
I don't know. I just don't know. I mean, it's an enormous demographic. It's incredibly difficult to get dressed and find clothes that work. I think maybe it's because this consumer just didn't pipe up and say, "What about me?" You know, they manage, they go to the tailor, and it's dispiriting and no fun, but, you know, no one's walking around naked. I also think people thought, how do you do it? There's a stigma. And people have tried. I was speaking to a customer the other day who said, "Oh, we're so glad you're doing this. It's, my husband's just, she's so happy," and all that. And she said, "There used to be a store in Washington that closed." And I said, "Oh, really? I don't know. But what store was that?" She said, "Oh, it was called the Short Men's Shop." And I was like, wonder why that closed. You know what I mean? I just don't think there's the way to do it. And I'm trying to do it in a new way.
Your company doesn't mention the word short anywhere. Is that a conscious decision?
Definitely. It is a stigma. It is a bummer in the world we live in. So why not sort of avoid it? I'm 5'8". I was having problems. I thought if I'm having, you know, issues, then definitely guys shorter will. You know, one of the funny things is men who are shorter, sometimes I'll tell them that I'm doing this, and they go, "Oh, really? Yeah, that sounds interesting. You know, I do okay." And they'll sort of walk away. And then they'll come back and say, "Hey, you gonna do polo shirts?"
What is so painful about making your pants a little shorter? What does it mean to have a company geared towards the 5'8 and under crowd? Is it just simply making shorter pants?
I don't think men want to shop. Mm-hmm. So they don't want to shop and then have to go for the second step of taking your clothes to the tailor. And also the proportion on things are wrong. So if you get pants shortened, they're still too wide at the ankle and they're too wide at the knee, and it makes you look shorter because your pants are too wide. So it's never quite right.
I heard that you wore a Brooks Brothers boys blazer for several years.
Yeah, you know, it's all true. I mean, men have had to, like, shop in the boys' department.
What is a tailor tax?
I call the tailor tax the money, the extra money one pays to fix your clothes. You know, I've shortened T-shirts that are just too long, or polo shirts that are too long, or I've had to take sleeves in because they're just too wide. I mean, it's really a pain. Mm-hmm. If you care, mm-hmm. it's a pain, mm-hmm. and it's a lot of money. And if you don't care, you don't look good.
I noticed you talk about your clothes being inspired by, you know, New York City street life, like the subways, for example. What is it about the subway that inspired your design?
Well, it was about color. The mosaics in the subway signs are these beautiful signs from when the subways were first made. Burnished reds and deep blues and kind of great sort of hunter green jewel tones. And, you know, there's a stop at 86th Street and a stop at Bleecker Street I call Bleecker Blue, you know, in my head, you know. So it's that kind of influence.
Now, you're still in the early days of the company. I mean, you launched in February 2012.
Oh, yeah, we're early.
So you're going through the process of defining and executing. And what has been harder for you than you thought, even not very far into the company?
Hard is getting your product made and done. And, you know, in factories that you're, you know, I'm a little pisher. I'm not a big gun yet. So you're not a priority, and how to make sure that you get the quality that you want, that's really a struggle.
The name of the company is eponymous, is Peter Manning. How did you ultimately come to that? Was it obvious, or?
I was talking to a branding firm that was helping me, and I came in into a meeting, and they said, your name is Peter Manning. People would pay us lots of money to come up with that name, and it's yours. In the early days, and still, I'll respond to a customer and they'll say, wow, it's you. And I'm like, sure, yeah, we all pick up the phone around here. There's no, you know, we all are helping. It's all hands on deck. So I think having someone behind it who's felt their pain and who wants the same clothes too is really makes a difference.
I'm Jessica Harris. You're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the clothing designer, Peter Manning. Peter is the founder of Peter Manning, an e-commerce clothing company for men 5'8 and under. You've had quite a career shift. Prior to starting Peter Manning, you worked in theater for over 15 years.
Yeah.
What drew you to theater initially?
I did start in the theater. I wanted to be an actor. But I loved it. I mean, growing up, I always did it, and I loved it. And then it got hard, and I wanted to see what the other side was about, because I didn't want to just sit around and complain about how, oh, there's no opportunities for actors and they don't really want me and all this stuff. I didn't like sitting around talking actor talk. And I got an internship at Manhattan Theater Club, and I worked there for 2.5 years and ended up saying, oh, producing. Mm-hmm. There's plays and there's this whole other side of it that I hadn't thought about.
You won a Tony Award in 1998 for Sideman, which was a show that you took to Broadway. A sideman is somebody who plays like in a jazz band, right? How would you just define what a sideman is?
A sideman is a guy who plays in a jazz band. He's a guy who plays for hire, you know, mm-hmm. so he can play in a big band there. He can play at a wedding. He can play, you know, he can play in an orchestra pit. He's just he's a journeyman musician.
Yeah.
And it was a play that I loved that I'd done at New York Stage and Film. When I left New York Stage and Film, I told the writer, Warren Light, I promised him that I would do the play in New York. I had no idea how I was going to do that. And every producer in New York had seen Sideman and turned it down. I knew that it would be a success. I just knew it in my bones.
How much of your memory does that project consume in your era of theater?
It was an incredible experience for so many of us. And part of it, just as we were moving from downtown to Broadway, our daughter was born. So it's sort of tied up in that as well. But Frank Wood, who played the father, was this journeyman actor who'd sort of been like a sideman, but an actor, because actors are like sidemen too. And he went on to win the Tony Award. Edie Falco played the mother before. I remember Edie Falco telling me at some rehearsal one day, going, oh, yeah, I got the show. It's The Sopranos. I remember vividly thinking to myself, wow, God, Edie sure doesn't seem like the sort of taffeta dress singing type. Because I thought it was – I had no idea. I mean, that's – so we were all kind of young and doing this thing we just believed in with all our heart. Mm. And it kind of – you know, you have this experience where you sort of put it together with tape and love and, you know, hope for the best. And everyone's working for nothing in conditions that are, like, you know, almost tawdry, and you sort of do it and get it on, and it works. And it just, I knew, and then moved to Broadway and then wins the Tony Award. It just, I thought, that's not going to happen again. So, you know what? Let me just put that Tony Award on my shelf and gaze at that and go home and take care of my kid, was sort of how it went.
Why did you make a shift from theater?
The easy answer and the quick one is that we had a child. And Andre, my husband, now husband, partner then, but now we're married, was the artistic director of Lincoln Center Theater. And I just thought, there's no way for both of us to have really the careers that you need to have in the theater, because you have to give 110% of the theater. There's no other way to do it half.
How did you meet Andre?
I interviewed to be his assistant. And we had an incredible interview that where we both were like, wow, something was happening here. But, you know, it was work, so we were, nothing did. And I didn't get the job because his assistant didn't end up leaving. But he left a message on the machine saying, well, there is no job, but let's get together for dinner sometime. And I thought, oh, wow, he must have felt it too.
And then you worked at Lincoln Center after.
I did, and that was a little tough. It was sort of exciting at first because no one knew about our relationship, and then it got annoying and hard after a while. That office romance stuff.
You're not the first.
Yeah, exactly.
You and Andre have been partners, and now he's your husband since when? Since
1991.
And you two have had kind of a personal entrepreneurial moment in having your daughter. Can you explain that?
We wanted a child, and, you know, so we sort of stumbled on an agency that was on 46th Street, and we did. But we also, when I look back, I think, wow, we kind of were out there on it. I think we're the first male couple in New York to adopt jointly.
And we take it for granted now because you have a lot of single-sex couples adopting, but you were the first.
Yeah, there are no – Katie has very few peers, and we're in New York. You know, we were always kind of the only two dads around for a long time. Now there's lots of them, which is great. Mm-hmm. But she's a real trailblazer too. So she's got to sort of blaze that trail too and explain all the time as well.
After you left the theater world, before starting the company, you went back to college because you hadn't finished college. You only had a semester left, but you actually went to 4 years at Columbia.
I did. And
focused on architecture.
Right.
So was the thought that you would go into a career in architecture?
Well, I kind of knew that I wasn't going to go into a career in architecture, but I knew that I wanted to finish this degree that was unfinished, and I knew that I loved architecture, and I didn't quite know where it would go. When I got out, a friend who'd been incredibly successful in real estate said, I think you'd make a good developer. And I said, really? What's that? And he said, well, let's go find something and let's do a project together.
It's in Nolita, which is on the Lower East Side.
Yeah.
On Elizabeth Street.
Yeah, it's a building that people can't believe is new. Mm. It's brick and wood windows, and has a kind of detail and kind of heft that buildings used to have 100 years ago.
So why from theater to architecture to clothing? How did you land here?
I landed here because I did the development. It was the same. I was using the same exact skills in developing the building that I was using in the theater. And I thought to myself, oh, I could do that clothing company that I've wanted to do literally since I was 10 years old. You know, there's a story. My mother, I was 10. We were driving in the car in Larchmont, New York, where I grew up. And I said, Mom, I want bell bottoms. And she said, oh, sweetie, I can't buy you bell bottoms because by the time I shorten them, they won't be bell bottoms anymore. Mm-hmm. And I remembered it vividly as, you know, yesterday. And I thought, that's really not fair. It's like the proverbial bell bottoms is my rosebud. You know what I mean? So that's what I've been searching for.
Your earliest memories associated with knowing that you were gay also tie into a sartorial moment, a connection to clothes when you were a child.
Right. I have this vivid memory of my going up the third floor stairs with my older sister, who's, I guess, nine years older than me, and saying to her, you know what I love? I love waking up in the morning because I can't wait to get dressed. And I have this mustard pair of, like, sort of pants that I loved. I remember my sister having a face on that was like, that's weird. You know, other 5-year-olds are not saying that. That doesn't mean you're gay, but I mean, it was, so I kind of always knew. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I hid it and like lots of people did and came out when I was 21 and everyone I knew was like, oh, really?
You had this love of style and clothes, you know, from the age of 5. How about your parents?
My mother was really, you know, she dressed beautifully. you know, she knew that girl, you know, she taught at a girls' school and she knew girls were watching, so she would pride herself on not wearing the same thing twice for, you know, weeks and weeks on time. She always looked put together and always managed to, you know, look great on without a lot of dough.
And why didn't you start this earlier?
I don't know. It didn't occur to me that I could. I mean, at the time, our building did very well, but the real estate market at the time had just dried up. And so I was sort of trying to figure out what was next. And I thought, you know what, I'm going to try and start this. And it's like this that thing, and that can happen. I sat next to someone at a dinner party who had a very successful career with retail. And I told her, I've always had this idea. And she said, that's a great idea. Hmm. Call these people. They're starting a like kind of consulting firm for new brands, and you should really do that. That's a great idea. Hmm. And so off I went.
When you initially launched Peter Manning, where did the capital come from?
I was able to get a loan, $200,000. It was the first time the bank ever gave a loan to a startup.
Hmm. What bank?
M&T Bank, mm-hmm. Because they believed in it. And so that's how I got started, because I was really at the moment where I was like, I can't, maybe I'm not going to pull it off. Maybe I'm not going to get there. And they approved the loan, and we're like, and I was like, we're off. Hmm. We can do this. But then it's like, well, now you have to go raise more money. But now we have a proven concept and sort of real growth, and people can go, oh, wow, you really are onto something. And when you're an entrepreneur, which I guess I am, I'm like the reluctant entrepreneur, sometimes you're so far out on a limb that you feel like it's going to break. You know, I've cried on street corners. Like, I don't know how I'm going to solve this. And then I remember that we're not curing cancer. We're just trying to sell some pants. Like, and you get through it, and everyone's going to live. And it, you know what I mean? When you feel so much and you want so much the right thing, you know.
Why have you cried on a street corner?
Okay, here's what. Chinos are a big part of our business. The chinos that came in right before we were to put them on sale came, and their back pockets were too shallow. Like, you couldn't get a wallet in them, all of them. So we had to send them back to the factory, and then they have to remake them. And they're like, ooh, sorry. I'm like, oh, sorry? Hmm. What? Didn't anyone ask? Like, these pockets don't seem right. Like, no one asked that question? And so I'm still waiting for those pants. They're currently in customs. I'm waiting for them to come. And so it's just brutal. I feel so deeply about my customer that it drives me crazy.
Your daughter, what role, if any, has she played in the founding of this company?
Well, it's funny you should ask. The New York Times did an article about me and the company in March of 2012. And at that time, she's in boarding school now, which she's an ice hockey player, and she'd gotten into the school, and we were going up for what is called the revisit, the weekend where you go and sort of go look at the school and decide whether you really want to go there or not. And that was the day that the New York Times article came out. Like, the New York Times article came out that morning, and we were in the car on our way 4.5 hours to New Hampshire for 2 days, and there was nothing I could do. And my BlackBerry is going, ping, 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 ping. And I'm thinking, I can't go to this school and, like, be one of those New York dads with my BlackBerry in the corner when everyone else is trying to, like, look like, oh, yes, we love it here and the trees are so pretty and, oh, so interested in this humanities class and, wow, the gym's great and the whole thing. And my BlackBerry is literally going to explode from, you know, orders that I'm getting. So I just said to Katie, I said, young lady, when you get home, you are going to work. And we came home, and it was all in our house. Like, one day, a truck came and delivered all these boxes, and I lugged it upstairs.
In Manhattan.
And she, for 2 days straight, for 12 hours, just like pushing it out. We'd push them out. I'd run to FedEx and drop them off. I mean, it was absolute insanity. I mean, a great lesson for a kid to sort of go, wow, this is how it works. You know, and I can see, too, sometimes when she's like, you know, the business, and it's like the other sibling.
It's competitive.
Yeah.
Do you ever see people on the street wearing your clothes?
I have, and it's so great. Just, you know, guy in a shirt and a khakis, and I just, you know, was driving, going by in a cab, and there he was, and I was like, there he is, he looks great. There's a very funny story. My daughter calls one day, and she's like, you're not going to believe it. This guy came up to me at school and said, hey, is your dad Peter Manning? And she said, yeah. And she's like, why? And she said, I wear his pants. It turns out she has a crush on him. So, you know what I mean? The whole thing is too weird, but very funny.
It struck me that, you know, here you are the producer of Sideman, and Sidemen being musicians in jazz bands, and your career has been somewhat of a jazz song, you know, kind of ad hoc a little bit, you know, going from, you know, this beat to that.
Yeah.
Have you thought about that?
I had never made that connection, but it does make a lot of sense, and it's true. You know, in jazz, I sort of pick up the melody wherever it comes from, and in Sideman, there's a monologue where he talks about his father playing, and he said, you know, he'd be playing the horn, and if a car horn blew outside, he'd incorporate that into his solo. And I guess there's a little bit of that in my life, sort of here are these things, and these sort of allowing them to give them life, you know, from a play to a kid to a clothing company to a building.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, it's been great to be here.
My guest has been Peter Manning, the founder of the clothing company, Peter Manning. If you'd like to learn more about the show, please visit our website at fromscratchradio.org or follow us on Twitter at Jess G. Harris or find us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.